From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate Frank Sinatra's 80th birthday.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual.
To help us celebrate Sinatra's birthday, we'll be joined by his daughter Nancy, one of his arrangers, Billy May, and one of his songwriters, Matt Dennis, the composer of Angel Eyes, Everything Happens to Me, and Let's Get Away from It All. We'll also talk with James Isaacs, who's produced two Sinatra box set reissues, and Charles Granata, project director of the New Columbia box set. Everyone on today's show will play us their favorite Sinatra records. An 80th birthday tribute coming up on Fresh Air.
Lots of forget-me-nots.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres has issued a new appeal to Syrian President Assad to join him in Middle East peace efforts. Peres addressed a joint meeting of Congress in Washington today. He said he's willing to negotiate relentlessly to achieve peace with Syria. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Peres spoke to Congress a year after his slain predecessor, Yitzhak Rabin, addressed lawmakers, noting that it was the same spot from which President Lyndon Johnson spoke shortly after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Peres quoted Johnson's lament, "All I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today." Peres pledged to build upon Rabin's efforts at peace and directed some comments at Syrian President Assad.
Without illusion, but with resolve, we shall stand ready to make demanding decisions if Assad is.
President Clinton is sending Secretary of State Warren Christopher back to the Middle East in hopes of jump-starting talks between Israel and Syria, which is demanding return of the strategic Golan Heights in exchange for peace. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Two French combat pilots are home again after 3.5 months in captivity. They were released this morning by the Bosnian Serbs. The French government insisted made no concessions to win the freedom of the two, but there has been speculation that the release may have come with strings attached, such as permission for Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic to attend the signing of the Dayton Peace Treaty Thursday in Paris. Karadzic and his top military commander are under indictment for war crimes, and the White House says if either man shows up at the ceremony, he will be arrested. The fire that destroyed much of a textile mill complex in Massachusetts overnight was brought under control this morning, but not before it had injured 33 people. Hundreds of workers faced the loss of their jobs. From member station WBUR in Boston, Jennifer Gorin reports.
The fire is believed to have started when a boiler in one of the buildings exploded last night, showering the mill complex with a rain of burning debris. The explosion knocked out the complex's sprinkler system, and within minutes, the buildings went up in flames. 8 employees working overnight shifts were critically injured, but so far there are no deaths reported. The mill is the largest employer in this industrial region near the New Hampshire border. Methuen Mayor Dennis DeZoglia says his city will be hard hit by the loss of jobs.
But we have 2,400 families who have been affected by this, which needless to say would cause a major economic hardship for those families, but also for the region.
City and state officials have been meeting all morning to map out a strategy to rebuild the complex or find a new home for the burned-out business. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Gorin in Boston.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 7.25 points at 5,177 in active trading. This is National Public Radio News. 2 people have been killed by falling trees as a huge windstorm blasts the West Coast. Gusts clocked at more than 80 miles an hour are ripping San Francisco. Power has been knocked out for thousands, and many schools are closed in California, Oregon, and Washington. The International Tribunal on Rwandan Genocide issued its first indictments today, setting in motion a trial that will likely continue for several years. The tribunal refused to announce the names of those indicted, though, fearing the suspects will try to avoid arrest. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
The court focused its first indictments on 4 specific massacres that occurred in western Rwanda, one in a Catholic church and one in a soccer stadium in the town of Kibuye, and 2 more that took place nearby in the countryside. The 8 suspects are accused of conspiring to kill 10,000 or more women, men, and children of the Tutsi ethnic minority. International arrest warrants for the eight should be issued in days. Many of the Rwandans accused of war crimes now live in various African and European countries. Those indicted are not the highest officials behind the genocide, but prosecutors felt it would be easier to begin by trying local leaders and then follow the chain of extermination orders to the top. Another round of indictments is expected in a few months, and the first trial could open in Arusha, Tanzania, the home of the tribunal, this March. This is Michael Scholar reporting.
NBC has been awarded the U.S. broadcast rights to the Olympic Games in the years 2004, 6, and 8. The network paid $2.3 billion for the rights. It was the first time a network has locked up coverage rights before the sites for the Games have even been chosen. Administration and GOP negotiators say the new economic projections released by the Congressional Budget Office this week should make it easier now to reach a balanced budget deal. One GOP congressman says the Republicans will offer an improved budget balancing proposal this week. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we celebrate Frank Sinatra's 80th birthday. We'll hear from some of his musical collaborators, from a couple of people behind his reissues, and from his daughter, Nancy. And we'll celebrate his birthday in the best way I can think of by playing some of his greatest recordings. Nancy Sinatra is our first guest. She's put together a book about her father to commemorate his birthday. It's called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. Nancy Sinatra had a few hit records of her own in the 60s, including These Boots Are Made for Walking and a duet with her father called Something Stupid. I asked her to choose a song her father recorded that has personal significance for her, and she chose this 1944 recording of She's Funny That Way, which he used to sing for her mother, his first wife. Nancy says many years later, her father said he still thought of her mother when he sang it.
I can't save a dollar, ain't worth a cent. She'd never holler, she'd live in a tent. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. Though she'd love to work and slave for me every day, she'd be so much better off if
Nancy Sinatra's new book comes with a CD that includes excerpts of Frank Sinatra's early radio broadcasts. I asked her to tell us about his very first radio appearance on the Major Bowes original Amateur Hour, on which he appeared in 1935 with the group The Hoboken Four.
They were a separate group, the three guys, and I think they were called the Three Flashes. Major Bowes knew they were all from Hoboken, and I guess that was his little brainchild. Or maybe it was just to shorten the time of their performances. I'm not sure why he put them together, but he did, and he named them the Hoboken Four. My dad traveled with them for a while and then began to resent the fact that he ended up as part of this quartet because he had auditioned as a solo artist.
So Major Bowes stuck Sinatra with this trio to form the Hoboken.
Exactly.
Okay. So this is Frank Sinatra's very first radio appearance, 1935, with the Hoboken Four.
Shine and sway your bluesy. Why don't you shine? Start with your shoesy. Shine each place up. Make it look like new.
Boom, 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 boom.
Shine your face up. Mm-hmm. I want to see you wear a smile at you. Oh, shine. You're these and those. You'll find everything turn out right fine. Folks will shine up to you. Everybody's going to hide you, do you? You'll make the whole world chocolate drops. Let me hear you. Shine up to you, everybody's gonna hide you, do you? You'll make the whole world shine. Shine and sway your bluesy.
Ah.
Shine, start with your shoesy.
Ah.
You'll make the whole world shine.
That's Frank Sinatra's first radio appearance. And my guest is Nancy Sinatra, who's written a new book about her father called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. Did your father talk with you much about those early days when he was trying to find himself professionally?
He talked a lot about his family in those days, how disappointed they were that he didn't stay in school. He told me a lot about his early jobs, washing dishes, just anything to scrounge up a few pennies. Now, he hates pennies so much, he doesn't even look at them. He ignores them. He puts them away in a jar, gets rid of them immediately.
I want to play another recording from the CD that comes with your new book, Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. And this is the recording of his last broadcast with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra when he's introducing his replacement, Dick Hames. This was recorded in 1942. Let's listen to it.
Folks, this is Frank Sinatra's farewell broadcast with his band. After tonight, he's going to be strictly on his own. And, Frank, I want to tell you that everyone in the band wishes you the best of luck.
Thanks, Mac, and I'd like to say that I'm going to miss all you guys after kicking around for 3 years. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to meet the boy who's going to take my place as the vocalist with Tommy in the band. He's a fine guy, a wonderful singer, and he was good enough for Harry James and Benny Goodman, and that's really saying plenty. Folks, I'd like you to meet Dick Hames.
Well, Frank, I don't know if anyone can really take your place with this band, but I'm going to be in there trying. You can bet on that. As for you, well, I know that you'll be knocking them dead on your own hook.
So thanks,
well,
Dick.
I agree with you there, Dick, and thanks a lot, Dick Hames. Frank, before you hit the road, how about one more song just for Auld Lang Syne?
That's all right with me, Tom. Give me the beat on our arrangement of the song as you, and I'll see what I can do with it.
I hear music when I look at you, a beautiful theme of every dream I ever knew.
Back with Nancy Sinatra, the recording we just heard is featured on a CD that comes with her new book about her father. Did he talk to you much about this period of his life, leaving Tommy Dorsey, or what it was like to be with the big bands?
Yes, we really went into that in depth because a lot of the legend, the negative legend or myth about him has to do with his leaving Dorsey and how he managed to get out of that horrible contract.
What was so bad about the contract?
It was over a third of his income that was sort of held hostage by Tommy Dorsey for the rest of Frank's life, which I thought was just horrendous. And it was handled by, the breaking of the contract was handled by the top agents and lawyers in the business in New York. And but the myth was that that mafia people, I don't even know who they were supposedly, but the myth was that these people went to Tommy Dorsey and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Mario Puzo told me that he made up that line in The Godfather, that he'd never heard that about my dad or connected with my dad. But now, of course, everybody thinks it's his. The Dorsey contract, according to my dad, was almost impossible to break. So he really had to get some very strong attorneys in there. And what they did was they reminded Tommy Dorsey that he liked broadcasting on NBC, and these people represented NBC. And they said, if you want to continue to work for NBC, you're going to have to let this guy go.
So what was the next step for your father after he left the Dorsey Orchestra?
Well, one of the legendary moments of his life. He went to the Paramount Theater alone, but working for, alone meaning not connected to an orchestra, but working for or with Benny Goodman. and his orchestra. And it was total tumult. I mean, the theater just, the way it was described to me was it felt like the theater was just going to come down.
When you were 4 years old, your father, I think he recorded Nancy with a Laughing Face.
Mm-hmm.
And that song was a present for you for your fourth birthday? Is that?
Oh, I don't know if it was a present. An interesting, sweet sidelight of that is that Jimmy Van Heusen, when I turned 16, he wrote the music for the song. He gave me his rights, his ASCAP rights,
really?
To the song when I turned 16. Isn't
what,
that dear?
That really is.
Isn't that adorable? I don't know if it was a gift for me when I was a little girl, but it certainly is a gift for me now. I love hearing it. Whenever I hear it, it brings a lump to my throat, you know. It's very sentimental.
Was it supposed to be about you? I mean, it sounds really like it's a song to a lover than a daughter, but...
No, it was about me, yeah. Lyrics written by Phil Silvers, the wonderful comedic actor, who also, by the way, named his daughter Nancy after the song.
Why don't we hear it?
Okay.
It's Frank Sinatra, Nancy with a Laughing Face.
If I don't see her each day, I miss her. Gee, what a thrill each time I kiss her. Believe me, I've got a case on Nancy with a laughing face.
My guest is Nancy Sinatra, and she's written a new book about her father called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. How much did you see your father when you were growing up? How much was he actually home?
Not a whole lot. He was really, I liken his work to traveling salesman. You know, he was pretty much a traveling salesman. I heard him on the radio a lot as a little girl. The most normal part of my childhood was when he was under contract to MGM and we were living in the San Fernando Valley in California, and we actually got to have dinner together and breakfast together, and that was kind of father knows best time for us.
When your father started having affairs with other women and that was being covered by the press, and your mother was finding out sometimes through press reports about it, what was it like for you in the house?
My mother had a knack, and still has really, of putting forward a happy face. She generally kept that stuff from us. After they actually split, when my dad was looking to marry Ava Gardner, I think the reality of it set in, and she could not help but be sad. I mean, it was just too tough for her. So for that period of time, we were sad also, because not because we understood divorce or anything. I mean, Dad, we were used to his being away. Tina never knew him any other way. But because of my mother's sadness, it was not self-indulgent in any way. It was just she couldn't avoid it. I mean, she would have heart palpitations and faint a little, or have what I guess used to be called the vapors. You know, she just couldn't get it together for a while. But life went on. I mean, we still, you know, we still kept our commitments to brownie troops or bluebirds or whatever we were doing at the time, and my brother with his Cub Scouts and all of that stuff, you know. Nothing really changed.
When your parents divorced, was your father still a part of your life, even though he was still on the road a lot and you maybe didn't get to see him very much?
Always. Yeah, always. Again, it didn't change much. It was really like he was still on the road in a way.
Now, when you were growing up, how did his records figure into your life or into your friends listening? Was that your music or was that just, you know, dad's stuff?
No, it was not our music. Our music was Elvis. Rhythm and blues was beginning then when I was a preteen and teenager. It was underground radio. We used to listen to a station that came on after midnight. And that's when we would hear the early R&B hits like the original Shaboom, for example. We did a dance called the DB, which stood for the Dirty Boogie. So, you know, to hear my dad and Nelson Riddle was not a big thrill, you know, for my friends. I, of course, had a great appreciation for it, and I was studying classical piano at the time. I studied for 12 years, actually, so I was getting a real musical education. My friends were much more interested in the other stuff.
Is your father singing anymore?
I don't know. You know, people ask me that with hopeful looks on their faces because they want to be able to say that they saw him perform.
Right.
But I can't promise that. I don't really know. Sometimes when we talk about it, he says, "Well, no, I'm happy now. I'm so content not having to schlep around the country." And other times he'll say, "You know, I miss it. I really think maybe I should go back to work." I don't really know.
Nancy Sinatra, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I've really enjoyed this.
Nancy Sinatra has written a new book about her father called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. Sometime soon on Fresh Air, we'll hear an expanded version of that interview in which Nancy Sinatra will discuss her own recording career. Coming up, our Sinatra birthday celebration continues. This is Fresh Air. For a lot of people, Frank Sinatra's records are bound up in memories of the past, but his records are also loved by people too young to have those associations. Foremost among his younger admirers is Charles Granata. Granata is a 32-year-old cop in New Jersey who has amassed so many Sinatra records, photos, and related material that he now has a Sinatra archive. Several Sinatra reissues have used graphics from his collection. Granata was the project manager of a box set of Sinatra V-discs, and he's project director of the new box set, Frank Sinatra, The Columbia Years, 1943-52. I asked Charles Granata to choose one of his favorite recordings from the Columbia years.
I think the one song that really typifies Sinatra at Columbia as a ballad artist, because primarily during the Columbia years, he was known as a ballad artist, and that's really the style that he perfected.
And we're talking about, what, the late 40s and early 50s?
Yeah, Sinatra was at Columbia from 1943 until 1952, and during that period, he developed his true song styling. I mean, Sinatra became a song stylist. He wasn't just another singer, and people really recognized Sinatra as a ballad singer. And I think the one ballad that I love that really typifies Sinatra as a ballad artist at Columbia is his version of Body and Soul.
Oh, that's a beautiful record.
It's gorgeous. It's got a great Bobby Hackett cornet solo. Sinatra's emotion is just right. I mean, everything about this recording is, for me, it's just perfection, and it really is the quintessential Sinatra Columbia song or ballad.
It's a great record. Let's hear it.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh, for you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul. I spend my days in longing, wondering why it's me you're wronging. I tell you, I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul.
Have you ever met Sinatra?
I met Frank at the Waldorf Astoria in 1985.
How did you get to meet him?
I just walked up to him. I knew we had seen his concerts at Carnegie Hall twice that week, and I knew that he went back to the Waldorf after he was done with the show, and my wife and I waited at the Waldorf in the alleyway where the cars come in, and he pulled up in his limo, and he got out, and we were the only people there. And he was very gracious. He signed an album cover for me, and he you know, talked to me for a minute. He was just very, very gracious.
What'd you say to him? Did you tell him, oh, I have a whole archive about you?
No, but at that point, you have to remember, I was only about probably 22 years old, and I was just awed that I was, you know, meeting Frank Sinatra. To me, that was just totally incredible. And I remember saying to him that I really appreciated his music and that I really loved the concerts that week. And the thing that struck me was that, you know, he very easily could have just signed this album that I gave him and just tossed it back at me. You know, he really took a lot of time. He looked it over and he kind of chuckled to himself, you know, as though he were remembering something about the album. And then he signed it, you know, and it's the Wee Small Hours album. And he's standing on a lonely street with a lamppost and he's got a cigarette in his hand. And I remember that he very carefully signed the F to the left of the cigarette, so he didn't go over the smoke, and then he looked at it, and then he continued to sign on the other side. He was just so nice about it. And then, you know, I'd heard horror stories, you know, that you couldn't get near him, and that if you approached him, that these bodyguards would pounce on you and kill you, and it wasn't like that at all. He was just very gracious. It was a great experience.
Well, Chuck Granata, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was great.
Charles Granata is the project director of the new box set, Frank Sinatra, The Columbia Years. We'll close this half hour with the record Granata told me was his favorite of Sinatra's swingin' songs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well? I've got
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Sense and Sensibility, from the Jane Austen novel, at select theaters Wednesday. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Let's take a boat to Bermuda. Let's take a plane to St. Paul.
The song we're listening to was written by Matt Dennis, who also wrote one of Sinatra's signature songs, Angel Eyes. Coming up, we talk with Matt Dennis as we continue our celebration of Sinatra's 80th birthday. We'll also hear from arranger Billy May, he arranged the record we're listening to now, and James Isaacs, who's produced two Sinatra box set reissues.
Let's get away from it all. We'll travel around from town to town. We'll visit every state. I repeat, I love you, sweet, in all the 48. Let's go again to Niagara. This time we'll peek at the fall. Let's leave our hut, dear, get out of our rut, dear. Let's get away from it all. We'll travel round from town to town. We'll visit every state.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're celebrating Frank Sinatra's 80th birthday. James Isaacs co-produced two box sets, Frank Sinatra, The Voice, The Columbia Years, a reissue brought out in the 1980s, and Frank Sinatra, The Reprise Collection, released to coincide with Sinatra's 75th birthday. Isaacs is also an arts reporter and program host at WBUR in Boston, where he's done both jazz and rock and roll shows. In his liner notes for the Reprise Collection, after describing Sinatra as the single greatest male interpreter of popular songs, Isaacs thanks his mother for giving him something to rebel against, then revere. I asked him to elaborate on that thought.
Well, like many of my generation and yours, Terry, I was initially put off by Frank Sinatra because he represented everything that I loathed as a 13, 14, 15-year-old, whatever. He was the personification of adult America in all of its evils. The phonies with capital P's, you know.
Lots of showbiz values.
Yeah, lots of showbiz values. You know, there's an album title for one of those Jackie Gleason albums on which Jackie Gleason conducted and featured the wonderful cornetist Bobby Hackett. And the album's title, Music, Martinis, and Memories. And that should have been one of Frank's titles, because that's kind of what I'm getting at here.
Now, when did you start hearing Frank Sinatra differently?
I think it happened, the revelation occurred in 1971.
And what was the revelation?
The revelation was that I was feeling particularly unhappy on one particular evening, and I had, you know, I'd always been, when I say always, I had since the age of 14 or so been a jazz fan, and a lot of the tunes that the jazz musicians recorded, of course, had been done first by Frank Sinatra, and I had found a bunch of albums. In those days, I was given to haunting used record stores, and on one particular afternoon, I'd found a bunch of Frank Sinatra capitals. Of course, these are the classic Sinatra albums from the 1950s, and they were priced at $3 for $5. I think that they were all in monaural. But in any case, because it's almost impossible for me to pass by a record store without buying something, I did take home these three or four Frank Sinatra albums, and one of those albums, of course, I remembered it from my childhood and adolescence, was Frank Sinatra Sings for Only the Lonely. And the album contains, among other things, Spring Is Here, Only the Lonely, Willow Weep for Me, Angel Eyes. And all of these, as a matter of fact, were I learned later, all of these were recorded on the very same day, May 29th, 1958, quite a session. And one of the tunes that was included there was Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry, which to me is the great Sinatra performance. And I was just sitting there in my lonely little room in Cambridge, and it all just came together. I said, God, this guy's really good.
And did you start seeking out more Sinatra after that?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, now, remember, I had already been exposed to much of Frank Sinatra through the stuff that I heard on my mother's car radio, because as she continuously reminded me, hey, my car, my radio. When you get your car, it'll be your radio. So I had no radio vote in that car. And we listened to William B. Williams, who was the dean of WNEW. He had a rich baritone voice, and he used to begin his program with, "Hello, world, this is William B." And of course, the world was expected to fall over as he started each and every broadcast with the chairman of the board, and then he wouldn't have to identify the chairman of the board because, of course, that was Frank Sinatra. So,
well, over the years, you've become a jazz critic, a radio host of jazz shows and rock shows and soul and R&B shows.
Yep.
And you've put together several collections of Frank Sinatra recordings. Mm-hmm. Play some for us now as a singer. What do you see as being Sinatra's contribution to singing?
Well, there are many, of course. The things that jump immediately to my mind are the cello-like sonority. You know, nobody sounds as beautiful as Frank Sinatra on a ballad, and nobody sounds as exuberant as he on an up-tempo tune. There's such a depth of feeling. I would guess that for whatever reason, he feels things more than the average human being does, and that's not always a good thing.
And what about his timing? I just find his timing so extraordinary.
When you say timing, I think you mean phrasing.
Rhythm and phrasing.
Yeah, well, the fact that so many jazz improvisers of the highest order have looked to Frank Sinatra for, if nothing else, repertory is significant here. I'm talking about Lester Young and Miles Davis, Red Garland, even Coltrane when he was still recording standard tunes. The fact that Frank Sinatra's recordings were of importance to people of this caliber says a lot to me.
You know, I think for people of our age who grew up with rock and roll, but Frank Sinatra was still having hits on the radio, mm-hmm. I think one of the things, speaking for myself anyways, one of the things I didn't like about Sinatra before I rediscovered him, was him singing rock songs. I mean, I still don't actually like him singing rock songs, but I think that he's incomparable when it comes to ballads and kind of swing tunes. But give him, like, a rock tune, and I just don't think it works. And I think that that's part of what alienated a lot of people of my generation to Sinatra.
Yeah, well, you know, radio was a very different experience in the mid-1960s than it is during the mid-1990s. And the top 40 charts, when in fact there was such a thing as a top 40 chart, were much more all-inclusive. They wanted my mother in the car to, at least for a moment, have something to identify with. And they wanted me, meaning somebody 15 years old, to have a lot more to identify with back then. So, yes, you would get the odd Sinatra cut, That's Life, or Strangers in the Night, or other tunes of that ilk. To me, they were mostly duds. He sings, I think, with great conviction on That's Life. You know, it's a blues. And he's doing the Ray Charles on that one. And it's okay with me, but I'm not much of a fan and never have been much of a fan of Scooby-Dooby-Doo and all that.
Let me ask you to choose your favorite Sinatra recording.
Well, for me, it's the second recording, the capital recording of Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry. Sinatra recorded it first for Columbia, July 30th, 1946, but he recorded it for Capitol at that famous May 29th, 1958 session with Nelson Riddle's arrangement, and every note on it is letter perfect for me.
James Isaacs co-produced Sinatra box set reissues for Columbia and Reprise. Here's Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry.
When I want rain, I get sunny weather. I'm just as blue as the sky. Since love is gone, can't pull myself together. Guess I'll hang my tears out to dry. Friends ask me out, I tell them I'm busy. I must get a new alibi. I stay at home and ask myself, who is he? Guess I'll hang my tears out to dry.
Coming up, arranger Billy May. This is Fresh Air. Frank Sinatra's great voice has been given a great setting by such arrangers as the late Nelson Riddle and my guest Billy May. May worked with Sinatra on and off from the mid-40s to the mid-80s. He arranged Sinatra's albums Come Fly With Me, Come Swing With Me, and Come Dance With Me on Capitol Records. He did the arrangements for the Ellington Sinatra album on Reprise. On Sinatra's 1979 release Trilogy, May arranged the section called The Past. They met in 1939 when May was playing trumpet and arranging for the Charlie Barnett Band, and Sinatra was singing with Tommy Dorsey. Let's hear one of the Sinatra-Billy May collaborations. Here's Come Fly With Me, recorded in 1957.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue.
Billy May, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Was Come Fly With Me your first collaboration with Sinatra?
Well, it was the first major collaboration. I had done some work with him when he first came on Capitol a couple of years prior to that.
Now, how did this session come about?
He had been doing some things with Nelson Riddle and Gordon Jenkins, and he decided he wanted to do some things that were swinging a little more, and he wanted, I guess he liked the stuff I had been doing for other people, and so he called me, and we were friends from way back. I knew him when he was with Harry James and Tommy Dorsey. I was with Glenn Miller and Charlie Barnett in those days, and we all used to hang around the same bars and everything, so I've known him for many years. Then I worked for him when he worked for when Axel Stortle was his music director. I did some ghosting for Axel. I did some arranging for him because he was doing the hit parade, and they've got a, you know, you had to do a lot of arranging on the night before the broadcast. So I did a couple of things for Frank back then. That was about 1945, 46. So I've known him for a long time.
Now, who chose Come Fly With Me?
Oh, that was, I think it was Jimmy Van Heusen and Sammy Kahn's idea, because they wrote the song, and they had the closing song, which was It's So Nice to Go Traveling. And that was the whole idea of the album. And I don't know whether they sold it to Frank first or they sold it to Capitol Records, but it was a good idea because all the songs in the album are traveling songs, you know, location songs, Moonlight in Vermont and Brazil and things like that.
I love this Come Fly With Me recording. It was a big hit in 1957. It went to number one on the charts, but it's a great record. Do you want to say anything about the arrangement you came up with for it?
No, I've always been a fan of Jimmy Van Heusen. You know, there's the songwriters he's from the old school of songwriters, and they were really better songwriters than we have today. But Jimmy was an outstanding one because he wrote so musical. So it was always a great pleasure to write arrangements on his songs. And I'd known he and Sammy for quite a long time, and it was just a pleasant assignment for me.
Now, you said Sinatra wanted, you know, an arrangement that really swung. What's it like to write an arrangement for him? I mean, Sinatra has such great timing in his singing. So how would you use that to think about the timing that you wanted for your arrangement? You want to give him support. You don't want to get in the way, on the other hand.
Well, you've got to stay out of the way of him. That's right. But by the same token, you've got to keep things moving behind him, and then give him a good lead in, and give him a good relief when he stops singing and the band comes in, whether it's just whether it's eight bars or whether it's just a little interlude. I try to make something out of it. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Now, did he ever have surprising ways of rewriting the melody in the way he'd sing it?
He's taken liberties with melodies all through his life. And the great thing about him is that he's got a great natural ear, and he not only sings well in tune, but he hears harmonic changes, which is everybody can't hear them. Fortunately, I have a little bit of that ability, and he hears it very well. And so if he does make a change, usually it's very good musically. It fits what the composer had in mind.
How would you and Sinatra go about choosing songs for the sessions you did together?
Well, usually he had the songs picked. He had worked with the record company or with the songwriters or the combination of the both of them, and then I would sit down with Frank and with Bill Miller, his piano player, and we would work out what keys he felt he would like to do them in, try them maybe a tone higher, try them a little lower, and then discuss the tempos and things like that, and that was it, you know, and then we'd go.
Did you do a lot of takes?
No, not on my stuff. He was a real fast one take, let's go home style.
What about Sinatra sets him apart from other singers in your mind?
Well, I think I told you that I've known him for such a long time, and he was around the big bands back in the early days, you know. And in those days, the musicians had a great camaraderie, and he fit right in. All the singers and everybody fit right in with the musicians in those days. And he's kept that camaraderie. He's had that feeling for musicians right along, whether you're the arranger or the conductor or whether you're just a sideman. He's always been friendly and always considerate of the musicians. I think most of the musicians that work for him are very happy to work on the dates for him. And I think it reflects in their playing.
Arranger Billy May. Coming up, we continue our Sinatra birthday celebration with songwriter Matt Dennis. This is Fresh Air. One of Frank Sinatra's signature songs, Angel Eyes, was written by my guest, Matt Dennis. Dennis also wrote several other songs that Sinatra recorded. Dennis first wrote for Sinatra when Sinatra was the singer with Tommy Dorsey's band, and Dennis was the band's staff arranger and composer. Here's Sinatra's 1958 recording of Matt Dennis's Angel Eyes.
Hey, drink up, all you people. Order anything you see. Have fun, you happy people. The drink and the laughs on me. Try to think that love's not around. Still, it's uncomfortably near. My old heart ain't.
ain't gaining any ground, because my angel eyes ain't here.
Matt Dennis, welcome to Fresh Air.
How do you do?
How did Frank Sinatra end up recording your song, Angel Eyes?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Jimmy Van Heusen, the famous songwriter, was a friend of mine, and he had done, he was preparing an album, producing it for Frank, called Only the Lonely. And he talked, told Frank about the song, and Frank really liked it. So it was very nice. He accepted the song, and I was so pleased that he used it, and I was more than pleased because there were a couple of memorable times when his version of it was quite startling. I don't know if you recall, a few years ago in the 70s, he had made up his mind he was going to retire and
right.
quit the business, and he did a final concert at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, and his final song was Angel Eyes, and very dramatically, he had the lights go off on him as he walked off the stage at the end of the song, where he used my line, "Excuse me while I disappear." And as he sang that last line, he disappeared. And it made the papers, I think, all over the world. It was a strange thing. They thought Frank was giving it up. And, of course, old Blue Eyes came back, as we all know.
Now, did you have any singer in mind when you wrote Angel Eyes?
I wrote Angel Eyes with a buddy of mine. We wrote, it's interesting, the fellow who wrote the lyric to that, Earl Brent, has passed away, but he was a top writer of songs along, he wrote with myself and others, and it was at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer out in Hollywood, Earl Brent. Now, we wrote that was one of three songs we wrote just for fun one night, and as luck would have it, it turned out fine. I got Angel Eyes to Ella Fitzgerald, and she was a champion of the song for many years. Herb Jeffries, are you familiar with him?
Yes.
He made the very first record of the song. Matt Cole made it, and he made a wonderful record of it in the 50s. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That was wonderful, with Billy May's orchestra on Capitol. That was a great record. These are top records that, in my mind, they'll always be in my mind. Frank got the song, and he latched onto it, and it became an identity with Frank because he used it so many times. And emotionally, I think it just happened to fit him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did Frank Sinatra do anything surprising with Angel Eyes?
Yes, it was his idea to start with the middle of the song, like an attention-getting line of the song, where it said, "Drink up, all you people." And it was very strong, and it set an example because it was copied by other singers all over the place. Very emotionally strong. And then he did that out of tempo dramatically, and then he went into the main theme of the song. And, of course, he repeated the middle that he just sung in the construction of the song as he went through it. But it was just great the way he did it. Drink up all you people, order anything you see. It was like he was talking to people firsthand, and I think that really caught the people's eyes, you know, and ears. That's what caught it.
As a composer, how do you feel about Sinatra as an interpreter of your songs?
I think he's wonderful because we worked together with the Tommy Dorsey Band originally when he first started. And I first started, I was hired by Tommy Dorsey to write songs. And I wrote my first two or three songs for Frank, and they were monumental records. Everything Happens to Me and Let's Get Away From It All. You probably remember the songs.
Oh, sure.
And the Night We Called It a Day, of course, came a little later. And that was a whole thing in itself, you know. But I did Will You Still Be Mine. Frank has sung that. I had another song called Free For All, which was a patriotic song during the war. And that was very big, too. And I worked with the Pied Pipers and Frank very closely.
You started working with Sinatra very early in his career, in the early 40s when he was still with Dorsey. Did you have any idea that he'd go on to become as popular, as important, as good as he did?
Oh, yes. After the success of a couple of my songs with Dorsey, the writing was on the wall as far as I was concerned. Not only for my songs, but for the way he was doing things. Because he had a sound, and his sound was very smooth, and it was a sound that was bound to catch on.
I would like you to choose one of your songs that Sinatra recorded that you particularly like his interpretation of.
Well, of course, Angel Eyes is a favorite.
Of course, we've played that one.
The Violets for Your Furs that he made for Capitol actually was a turning point in his career. His records had slumped. You might have read the history of that period. It was in the 50s, and it looked like they were turning him off a little bit, the public. But he made an album called Songs for Young Lovers for Capitol Records with Nelson Riddle. It was his first album with Nelson Riddle's orchestra. And they became a team like he had with Axel Stordahl before Axel went on. And this album where he did Violets for Your Furs, he had already done this with the Tommy Dorsey Band originally in the 40s, in 41. And it was a wonderful recording, and it was monumental as far as I was concerned, and the critics thought so too.
Well, I want to thank you very much for helping us to celebrate Frank Sinatra's birthday, and I also want to thank you for all the great songs you've written.
Well, thank you very much for appreciating it, and I'm in touch with Frank quite often, and he's the one and only, you know. That's all I can say. He's great.
Matt Dennis spoke to us from his home in California. We'll close our birthday tribute with Sinatra's 1953 recording of Matt Dennis's song, Violets for Your Furs.
It was winter in Manhattan. Falling snowflakes filled the air. The streets were covered with a film of ice. But a little simple magic that I'd heard about somewhere changed the weather all around just within a trice. I bought you violets for your furs, and it was spring for a while, remember? I bought you violets for your furs, and there was April in that December.
Our Sinatra 80th birthday tribute was produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
The snow looked like dew on the blossoms as on a summer day. I bought you violets for your furs, and there was blue in the wintry sky.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publisher of Sophie's World, a novel about the history of philosophy. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.